Hello and welcome to Tablets Israel Update. It's 172 days to the war. It's the 27th of March, 2024. I'm Gadi Taub in Tel Aviv and fixing the frame with the last few bits of attention is Mike Duran at the... Mike, where are you?
I'm at the headquarters.
The headquarters, Gadi, of the August Hudson Institution, which also give us their auspices for this also August podcast. And we're joking, but it's been a terrible week. People in Israel are saying America stabbed us in the back in our time of need. Nothing short of that. Of course, that's not what everybody says, but that is certainly the mood among the informed Israelis.
I'll tell you what the uninformed are saying in a minute. Something different.
I was going to do that too. Maybe it's the same thing. And maybe you're going to steal my dumbest take on the news. I don't know. I'm smelling Ben Kaspit in the air.
He's coming. He's got big.
He's coming. I'm totally surprised and shocked, Dr. Duran. But why don't we start right off with the news?
Okay, well, of course, Gadi, the biggest thing in the news is the ongoing crisis between the Netanyahu government and the Biden administration. That crisis intensified on Monday when the United States abstained in a vote in the Security Council on a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and the release of the hostages. And that the U.S. abstained rather than doing what it normally does, which is to veto these resolutions. Prime Minister Netanyahu responded to the U.S. abstention by canceling the scheduled departure of Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer and National Security Council Director Tsachi Hanegbi to Washington for meetings to discuss alternatives to a major ground operation in Gaza. This crisis in the U.S.-Israeli relations comes while tensions inside the National Unity Government are intensifying. The main subject of the main point of contention inside the government is the military draft bill. A scheduled cabinet meeting was first postponed and then canceled yesterday after Prime Minister Netanyahu failed to come up with an agreement on the draft military bill and the military draft bill on the bill to draft people into the military. The draft bill to draft people into the military. He failed to come to agreement with the Haredi parties. These are the ultra-Orthodox who are seeking exemption for ultra-Orthodox men from military service. The cabinet was scheduled to vote on a resolution that would lay out in broad brushstrokes the contents of the military draft bill, but talks came to an impasse. Now, this is causing severe tensions between inside the coalition, between on the one hand, Netanyahu and the Haredi, the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, and on the other, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, who's in Netanyahu's party, and Benny Gantz from the National Unity Party, who joined the National Unity government after October 7th. Gantz and Gallant are opposed to the exemptions, apparently the exemptions that are being considered for the ultra-Orthodox. Now, Gideon Saar, who was in the National Unity government and has allied with Gantz, he resigned from the government, not citing the military draft bill, but citing the failure of the government to include him in decision-making over the war. His resignation a couple of days ago has prompted much speculation about whether Benny Gantz is going to join him, calling Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's outline for a Haredi draft bill a red line. Benny Gantz declared that his National Unity Party will not be able to remain in the coalition if the draft bill is passed. This is Gantz talking. He says, the people The people will not be able to put up with it. That's the military draft bill. The Knesset will not be able to vote for it, and my friends and I will not be able to be members of the emergency government if such legislation passes the Knesset and enters the statute books of the State of Israel in a way that would harm the unity and security of the state in general, during wartime in particular. Gantz stated this all in a video message. And as you mentioned, Gadi, of course, senior Israeli columnists, or as you alluded to, senior Israeli columnists are criticizing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for his handling of the relations with the Americans. Ben Kaspit, arguably the most prominent columnist in Israel, writes the following. I know you didn't want to believe that. I know you didn't want to hear. I said that to get a rise out of you. Anyway, Ben Kaspit writes, even if he were completely right about the issues, and he isn't, Netanyahu's reaction to the Americans is madness. Netanyahu humiliated the American administration, and he did that for no reason, just because he felt like it. Netanyahu's primary objective in this needless and delusional crisis with the administration that he created yesterday is to change the media agenda and to have the public conversation become all about a duel between him and Biden instead of the disastrous draft Dodgers bill that is slated to be discussed by his government. He is prepared to sacrifice Israel's relations with the United States for a short-lived political media coup. He has completely lost it. Every additional day that the man is in office,
I think that's enough, Mike. Damage. Don't you?
Yeah. But I wanted people to get the full flavor of.
And it's always the same. It's been like that for years. And you know when it started? It started because Netanyahu started excluding Ben Kaspit from the press.
Okay, conference. Hold on. I got one more thing on the news here. And that is finally a very important issue. On the northern front, hostilities between Israel and Hezbollah have escalated. The two sides traded blows yesterday, with Hezbollah attacking the Mount Meron Air Force Base, Israeli Air Force Base, targeting civilian communities along the Lebanese border, firing a large salvo of rockets at the Golan Heights and the Galilee Panhandle. But this morning, Hezbollah hit Kiryat Shmona, and a 25-year-old man was killed by a rocket. A second person sustained light injuries. So amidst this crisis inside the government, crisis between the government and the Americans, there's also an intensification of fighting in the north. A lot of bad news, Gadi. Over to you.
Yeah, well, a few more, some remarks on the items on the news, and one more item that I wanted to add about the draft bill, because the issue is complicated to explain in its totality and its history. But what you need to know is that this is a trap for the right-wing coalition, and they were ready to spring this trap right after the judicial reform collapse. So they were ready to, they started with these billboards about this coalition of embezzlers and draft dodgers.
Right.
And the trap is constructed like this. The Supreme Court is not going to allow any legislation that it deems violating the principle of equality, which is it has written into our non-constitution. It doesn't exist. And of course, doesn't apply to the Arabs. And if Netanyahu obliges and has a draft law that answers the full requirements of equality, meaning all these ultra-Orthodox young men will be suddenly drafted, then his coalition will collapse. And the problem is not Benny Gantz.
Let me just make sure that we're everyone's following along. So the legal establishment is demanding that ultra-Orthodox men be drafted in some significant numbers, and they are demanding an answer to Netanyahu on this subject. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
And that's where the government is having meetings and negotiations with the Netanyahu is having negotiations with the ultra Orthodox to come up with something that will satisfy the legal imperative that has been placed on the government.
without forcing them all to suddenly join the army or to be drafted, because then his coalition will collapse because it relies on the ultra-Orthodox parties. Now, Gantz leaving the government, if the suggested bill passes, is an excuse, will look like an excuse, will be a grave mistake, in my opinion, on his part, and will also not be enough to topple the government, because there's a 64-seat right-wing bloc that supports it. And if Gantz would leave now, he would be seen as deserting the ship in the midst of a storm for what is and looks like an excuse, especially since Gantz is on record once saying, when he was a candidate, saying that he will give the Haredim, the ultra-Orthodox, a blank paper with his signature, and they can fill in whatever they want. So now he's suddenly grandstanding about
we see, values. But for the first time, you and I have been talking here basically since October 7th. But anyway, we've been talking for a long time about how the pressure from the Americans and the pressure from the opposition to Netanyahu could converge and create a situation in which Netanyahu could be toppled. And until now, your main line of analysis has been that the pressure from the Americans is actually pushing Gantz into the hands of Netanyahu. Yeah. But now, in this week, this is the first time that I can kind of see a clear scenario whereby the Americans, together with the Israeli opposition, I mean, working not necessarily hand in glove, but in parallel, could actually bring down the government. I can see how this would, because I was trying to suggest this in the news without getting too much detail. Gallant, the defense minister, is also going along with Gantz in saying that if the ultra-Orthodox don't accept, come up with a serious contribution to manpower in the IDF to allowing ultra-Orthodox men to be drafted, then he can't go along with it, and that could be then the end of the government. No,
that's a danger, and Gantz is Gallant is indeed a Trojan horse. There was when the coalition was just constructed or somewhere around at the time of the collapse of the legal reform. There's a very good comedian in Israel. His name is Guy Hochman, and he's very, very in your face and rude, but in this sweet way, he gets away with things no one else says. And he was invited to a Likud party where, the prime minister was there with his wife and all the Likudniks, and he had one line about everybody. And he let he allowed himself to joke about Sarah Netanyahu, about Netanyahu himself, everyone. He made fun of everyone. And then he said, "Where is Gallant?" "Oh, probably in the opposition party." And so there was a this is enough to be, it's folklore that everybody understands that it, the joke and the reference. And now something that isn't funny at all. The anti-Netanyahu demonstrations, there was a curve, because they are constant. There is always a wild, crazy, fanatic core that is camped outside wherever Netanyahu lives and makes noise with drums and bullhorns everywhere. And some of them speak about how he will end like other dictators, and some of them explicitly insinuate that his whole family should be not just ousted of office, but also receive capital punishment. Things that are really wild. If anything like that was on the right, it would have long ago put these people in jail. But now this crazy fanatic core has come up with a plan to invade the private residence of the Netanyahus in Caesarea, and they with unbelievable.
I saw that they have an actual military plan to take over the prime minister's house.
And here it is on your screen. To those of you listening to us on audio, this is a photo, an aerial photo of Caesarea with the prime minister's house encircled with a dotted red line, as army maps signify enemy. And then there are the different routes of invasion where the different forces should camp. And this map was found by the police. But I'm telling you already, whoever produced this will probably be interrogated, get a little slap on the wrist, and nothing else. What we call incitement in the days of before the murder of Rabin is not 3% of the wild incitement against Netanyahu and
we need to explain what you're talking about, because Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated against the background of the Oslo process, the steps that he took toward a two-state solution with the Palestinians. He was assassinated by a right-wing extremist, and the left habitually blames Netanyahu for inciting the murder of Rabin. So what you are saying here, I'm just saying this so that people who haven't been following Israeli politics for the last 20 or 30 years can follow what you're saying. What you're saying here is that what we're seeing on the left today, what the left calls incitement by Netanyahu back at the time of the assassination of Rabin, pales in comparison to what we're seeing here.
Yeah, more than that, Netanyahu himself, although blamed for incitement, did not incite. In fact, when he gave speeches to Likud rallies and people shouted in the crowd, Rabin is a traitor, he would stop them and say, he's not a traitor, he's a political opponent and we are brothers. And what the left says is that in the crowd were people holding posters of Rabin in SS uniform, and that fact that he did not have them taken down is proof that he was approved them and participated in the incitement, which is ridiculous because the signs were very small and very far from where he was giving the speeches, and probably he could hardly see them from where he was, if at all. And now these people they've tried to invade the prime minister's residence in Jerusalem. They broke one barrier. This is but since they are our people, the media doesn't call them out, the prosecution doesn't prosecute them, and the police in rare cases detains someone for a few hours. But because the folklore is that the left is never violent. And so the left only talks.
So let me stop you here and ask you a question, because as I mentioned a minute ago, for the first time this week, I can see the scenario by which all of this could actually bring Netanyahu down. I really feel like the ground underneath them is really starting to crumble now. But like I said, you have been saying that the American pressure is actually backfiring, because it is, you know, where Ben Kaspit says that Netanyahu is presenting he's purposely exacerbating the conflict with the Americans in order to increase the support for him domestically and change the story. You have said that no, the Americans themselves are succeeding in unifying the country behind Netanyahu, or at least giving Netanyahu enough popularity on this issue to stay in power. What's your feeling now? Do you stay with that, with the analysis, or do you think that this the confluence of the military draft bill, the crisis with the Americans, and the failure to finish the job in Rafah is going to bring Netanyahu down?
I think it depends, and I can't predict, because I don't know what the reaction among his supporters would be if we do not begin a military operation in Rafah, as clearly a majority of Israelis believe is indispensable to winning the war. So now many of us think that America is going to make us lose the war. And if Netanyahu Netanyahu does not stand up to American pressure, then he will be in serious trouble, because the forces that want him out of office are constant, but the forces that support him will be shaken. But the very first reaction, the very first result of the outrageous American action in the Security Council was that Gantz was forced to side with Netanyahu against the United States in a tweet, although he said he shouldn't cancel the delegation, Netanyahu himself should go to America and patch up things. But he said the Security Council resolution, he objected to it, and said, and he said that we have a moral obligation to finish this war. And so again, Gantz has rallied to Netanyahu's position, if not Netanyahu himself.
Sorry, go ahead. Keep going.
And so did Gallant. Both of them said that the Israel must continue the war until complete victory over Hamas. So in that sense, American pressure, since American pressure is not perceived in Israel as pressure on Netanyahu per se, it's perceived as pressure preventing us from winning the war. And that is highly unpopular. And this now too traps Gantz and Gallant. If you leave in our jargon taken from the military, we have katef mitachat la'alunka, your shoulder under the stretcher. In a time of dire need, you cannot just drop the stretcher and expect the public then to support you. So note that even Gantz's calculations, the first threat that he has now of leaving the cabinet is about the ultra-Orthodox draft bill, not about the breach with the United States.
My mind always goes to military analysis first. And there are two things that concern me as someone whose number one goal is to see Hamas defeated and Iran weakened. So that's my number one, and my two number one goals. My number one goal is to see Iran weakened, and that means defeating Hamas. The first is that the Americans, you know, Biden's red line about not initiating a ground operation in Rafah, with the UN resolution on Monday, he's really shown that he's going to fight for this red line, and he means business. It's quite a serious thing, I think. It's going to be very hard for the Israelis to turn around and say, screw you, Washington, we're going to do this anyway. And secondly, and maybe even first, it's the intensification of the fighting in the north with Hezbollah. That is, to my mind, that is in some ways the real war. I understand that from the point of view of the Israeli public and the way events unfolded, that Gaza is foremost on everyone's mind. But in terms of the strategic balance with Iran, the more significant theater is the northern theater. And this this crisis with the Americans with the northern question unresolved is very worrying. It's extremely worrying. If you're an IDF commander, you cannot in good conscience say, we're going to go defy the Americans in Rafah and forget about the impact that the crisis with the Americans might have on the northern front. Because if it were to go to war in the northern front, you need the Americans more than you need them in Gaza. Am I making sense? Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely. I think the situation is graver than you assume. I think that Israel is under mortal threat. And I think that absolutely we should go into Rafah right now. That was my first tweet after the Security Council resolution, was go into Rafah now, because we can't count on American support. This is what we need to do. The way out of this, as I see it, is to be also wise about the limits to which Biden can apply pressure on Israel. There's also a limit to that. So
finish your thought. This is very interesting what you're saying. I have a historical I have an historical response to anecdote to tell you. Go ahead.
So the first thing I think we should do is show that we can go crazy and also defy the United States. And I think, I don't want to sound apocalyptic, but see, if we calculate rightly that losing the war in the Gaza theater can start a chain reaction which would bring the annihilation of Israel, which I think is not out of the question, then I think we should make clear and insinuate. Don't threaten. We don't need to threaten. But I think the United States needs to understand that if pushed to the wall, Israel will start a war big enough to drag America into it. Now, that's a very, very bad scenario. The price for that will be very, very heavy for Israel in the long run. But if the alternative is a second Holocaust, which is on Israelis' minds, then that option is, I assume, at least on the thoughts, if not yet on the table, of anyone who purports to lead Israel through this crisis.
Let me restate what you just said. And I think you'll probably agree with every word I'm going to say, but let me make sure. Because I would have made your point slightly differently. And I would say that the United States, by putting pressure on Israel at this particular moment and in this particular way, has, number one, hardened Hamas in its position against Israel. Hamas is not going to surrender. Hamas is not going to make a hostage for prisoners deal with Israel that is acceptable to the vast majority of Israelis. And it's going to hold out in the hope that it can stay alive in Rafah. And so that by staying alive in Rafah, it can actually dominate the day after in Gaza. So all that the United States says that it wants in Gaza, its own policy is making impossible by giving aid and comfort to Hamas and ensuring that it will live to fight another day. At the same time, it is also eroding Israeli deterrence against Hezbollah and Iran, and it is forcing Israel. It is forcing Israel to take possibly even harsher positions against Hezbollah at this moment than it would otherwise, because it has to demonstrate to the Israelis, understand that Israel looks isolated. It is isolated diplomatically, and it has to send a message to all of its enemies that diplomatic isolation will not lead to military weakness that can be exploited by them. Is that all fair? Are we on the same page?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we are.
And then actions, military escalation by Israel is designed to deter its enemies, but also to signal to the Americans that we're in this together. You can't just simply mediate between us and the Iranians, us and Hezbollah. American interests and Israeli interests are intertwined, and you have to carry out policies that will actually strengthen your ally rather than weaken it.
Yeah. Plus, we need to embarrass the Biden administration domestically with its failed Iran appeasement policy. And we should start saying it directly. And it's becoming easier, Mike. It's becoming easier because the minute this United Nations Security Council resolution was passed, Hamas applauded it. So when you look at the news, you say, oh, so Biden now allowed in the Security Council, first he deserted his ally in a time of need, but then he allowed the new axis of evil, the China, Russia, Iranian axis, to put forward their resolution, which detached the question of the hostages from the question of ceasefire, and basically joined a resolution that they initiated and Hamas applauded. So ask yourself, we should say to Americans, on which side is the Biden administration? Does it have Israel's back, or does it have Yihya Sinwar's back? And it increasingly looks like they have Yihya Sinwar's back. And into my mind, forgive me, Ben Kaspit, Netanyahu is being very, very mild for now. He did the right thing when he canceled their delegation, but he should be much firmer now, because we should, you know, Benny Gantz is still operating on the assumption that you ridiculed long ago when you said that some Israelis think that if we just get close enough with the Americans and explain to them the problems with the JCPOA, they will understand and come around. And as you know, the what's the name of this Iranian spy that was in charge of Rob Malley? Was
Rob Malley is not an Iranian spy. But go ahead. All right. I can't.
Iranian
I can't,
spy. What would you call it?
I would say
violation of FARA. In violation of FARA regulations.
I would say that he is just like Netanyahu said about Rabin. He's somebody with whom we have strong policy differences, and he's a brother.
Yes, but he was kicked out of the administration for violating the dress code or something other. So Rob Malley would come here and nod at Israeli government official, explaining to him that Iran is actually building a weapon, a nuclear weapon, and thinking to himself, of course they are. This is what the JCPOA was about in the first place. And the people like Gantz think that if they whisper on the ears of the Americans what we know about the Iranian problem, they will come around. Netanyahu, on the other hand, as you know, went to speak to the two houses of Congress. We recently screened this on one of my Hebrew shows. There was a standing ovation when he just began. I wonder if that would be the reaction today. What Netanyahu did then, he should do now. And as you know, because we once went together to check this, didn't we? When I had Netanyahu on my Hebrew podcast, he said, he was then in the head of the opposition. He said, Joe Biden, when he came into office, said, let's keep the disagreements between us about Iran behind closed doors. And I misquoted him saying, I said, Joe, no. And it's not the exact quote, but this is the content. He said, no, we're not going to keep it behind closed doors. And if that's meaning, if that's what you're going to do, we're going to embarrass you.
That's what he did with, they kept the Lapid government, Lapid and Gantz. They kept the disagreement pretty much behind closed doors.
Yes. And we saw what the results were. The results were an unbelievably beneficial maritime border agreement. By beneficial, I mean beneficial to Hezbollah.
It brought peace and prosperity to Israel. Remember that.
There's a clip of Yair Lapid, who loved to record himself with people calling him prime minister. So there's a voice behind the camera that mentioned this, saying, prime minister, what are the advantages of the maritime agreement? And he said, well, for one, we have now peace in, and so on, peace and quiet in the north.
Will you do me a favor, and from now on our podcast, will you call me prime minister?
No, but I can call you. I can call your office headquarters if you wish.
Okay. I'll take what I can get.
This is the once successful Israeli negotiation tactics. Always give what they already have. Now they switched. Now we always get what we already have. So Lapid also trumpeted the agreement and said that a gas field is on our side, a gas field is our side on the border in the sea, which it was before. Now part of it is not, but we should be happy about the part that there is. We gained not losing the full gas field. So
I was out in California last week. And I talked to a lot of people on a secret mission. I talked to a lot of people, and I was amazed at how effective the anti-Israeli propaganda the anti-Israeli positions of the White House have been in switching minds. I talked to a lot of people who, in another context, would be very sympathetic to Israel, who were saying things like, yeah, I don't like the Biden administration's policy, but the Israelis have really screwed up. I mean, they really mishandled this and so on. It's interesting to see how how all the criticisms of Israel start to become mainstream, even among people who are not supportive of the Biden administration. It's disturbing to watch.
Not interesting is not the word. It's disturbing and worrying, and it's also part of a wave of anti-Semitism, and to which at least some Jews are beginning to wake up, if belatedly, especially progressive and liberal Jews. There was a speech by Dershowitz criticizing the Biden administration. I haven't heard it, only heard of it.
I didn't see it.
But apparently some people are beginning to switch allegiances. So hopefully this policy of the White House will not remain popular in America for long.
Maybe we'll see. So, Trump's statements haven't been as pro-Israel as one would hope.
We don't know, but would you assess that Trump would go back to his maximum pressure policy against Iran, or will he adopt appeasement?
I would hope that he would go back to maximum pressure, but that's hope. I have to say, the civil war in the Republican Party right now, for the soul of the Republican Party, is bringing out a lot of forces who are basically putting forth the same arguments that we're hearing on the progressive left about how our allies in the Middle East are dragging us into commitments that are not in our interest, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So personnel will be policy. We have to see who he chooses to represent him in the government if he wins, and we'll see where he comes down. I think ultimately. He's going to be, his inclination is going to be more supportive of the Israelis than Biden has been. But we have to wait and see. I mean, these are unprecedented times in the United States. And I'm very much aware of the fact, that's why I'm asking you, how do you feel now about your analysis? I'm very much aware of the fact that my gut level understanding of what is happening in America is not necessarily reliable anymore. I used to be pretty good at just having a sense of the country, and I could read the news and kind of imagine how different people are reacting to it. And so much has changed so quickly in the country that I can no longer do that. You have to test every proposition.
I would add this, that the most important question is not what Trump's policy towards Israel would be, but what his policy towards the Middle East as a whole would be, and if he continues the policy that they call in the Biden administration regional integration, I would be greatly surprised. So, and this is the crucial question for the future of the Middle East. And it also, if you think about this in purely American interest terms, then obviously, a nuclear Iran going wild is not in America's interest.
I agree with everything you're saying. It's just that in the 4 years of the Biden administration, Iran has been able to pocket so many advances that rolling them back is going to take real would take real work. And a simple return to maximum pressure is going to be very difficult to implement. I mean, he might do it. I won't say no, but the world has changed in the last 4 years, and the domestic context for all of this has changed as well.
Yeah. So on this wow, it's been a worrying conversation, or a heavy conversation.
Sorry. Well, troubling times. Should we go to the dumbest take?
Yeah. So let's start with your dumbest take.
Well, my dumbest take, I was looking for something funny, and it's not so funny, but it's kind of worrying as well. But anyway, here it is. White House National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said that Washington was puzzled, Gotti, by Prime Minister Netanyahu's decision not to send a delegation for talks with top U.S. officials. And he said that the decision stemmed from domestic political concerns by Netanyahu, thereby lining himself up with Ben Kaspit. Kirby said, and I quote, "The Prime Minister's office seems to be indicating in public statements that we somehow changed here. We haven't, and we get to decide what our policy is. It seems like the Prime Minister's office is choosing to create a perception of daylight here when they don't need that." And I just thought, this is the most passive-aggressive statement that I've seen coming from a spokesman. Our policy hasn't changed. We haven't changed. They're creating this perception. This is coming from about a month ago, early February, a month and a half ago, there were a couple of articles that came out, one right after the other, one on NBC News, if I recall correctly, the other one in Politico, five or six, I don't remember, a whole slate of senior officials told NBC News that Biden had called Netanyahu an asshole. And then in Politico came out with a report in which Biden was quoted as saying about Netanyahu that he's a bad effing guy. Quote, a bad effing guy, unquote. But we're not trying to create any daylight between between Israel and Washington. We're united with the Israelis, united.
Israel just keeps backing up on our knives. What's the matter with them?
Yeah, we're not driving them in its back. They just fall onto these knives. What's wrong with the Israelis?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I thought that was really, really amazing.
Well, my
it gets the most, it may not be the dumb mistake, but it's the most passive aggressive.
So mine may not be funny, but it certainly qualifies as very, very dumb. And this is the whole choir of the Israeli press that says Netanyahu has ruined the relationship with Washington. And that's the line. I'm waiting for a time, Mike, to see, because we are gradually schooled to assume that the press is lying to us all the time. So will there be a point where we, like the Soviets, will begin to say that Izvestia niet pravda, a pravda niet izvestia? It's Izvestia is the news, pravda is the truth. And the Soviets, the Russians used to say that in the news there's no truth, and in the truth there's no news. So at what point will that happen in Israel? And mind you that in the age of the reform, where the half the country started to believe that the judicial reform is the beginning of a messianic dictatorship, we who supported it and were intimate in the right knew that they were lying. So half the country knew that the other half is completely duped. And so in my estimation, this is a progression. People think this is a constant. I don't think it's a constant. I think gradually you learn to think of the media in different terms, with the exception of very reliable podcasts like Gatekeeper in Hebrew and Israel Updates in English. And here we conclude this somber episode of Israel Update. We will be with you again, I think, from the Hudson headquarters, both of us, Mike, next week.
Oh, you'll be in, you're coming to the headquarters.
I'm coming to the headquarters. And in that beautiful room with the green H in the background, we will record another episode of this August podcast. Don't forget to tune in next week on Wednesday again. Thank you for watching and listening.